Welcome to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud, available on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, just about any other audio app. Head on over to the website, AmericaOutLoud.com, and check out the articles and podcast, and please share those on social media. We have a big show for you guys tonight, but first off, let me say hello to Rob. How are you doing tonight?
You know, I'm doing real good. Glad to be on another night, America Out Loud. Rob and Andrew, After Dark, ready for this show, or the guest that we have that's coming on, Michael Johns, who's a co-founder of the Tea Party. And we've spoken with him before, Andrew, and he is really insightful and has a command of many different topics. There's a lot that's taking place in the world around us. We have Joe Biden's first 100 days, and it seems, maybe I'm wrong, that the media, they're just like having a newborn baby, that this guy did such a remarkable job. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I'm like, that's questionable. And who did they survey to get this information? Now, granted, I'm sure that there are people out there that are saying, oh, he did good, he did good, but I never got the call. And there are a lot of other people whom I don't think got the call, not that they had to call us, but to make it seem as if though that these numbers are accurate, and I have no way of saying that they're not, but I got a gut feeling that no matter what Joe does, they will say that he walked on water. We have a crisis at the border. Kamala Harris is refusing to go to the border. Joe is yet to go to the border. Why are they afraid of the border? They're telling these people to come in, and I would think, I mean, maybe it's just me, that they would want to go to the border to say, hey, we're not a racist country. And even if you are, we're here, we will protect you. But we're not getting any of that. Why would Kamala be afraid to go to the border? Why would she want to say, hey, it's me, I'm one of you, come on in? But they won't go to the border. And then this whole thing with COVID-19 and 100 days, and of course tell us, take off your mask. Because remember, Joe had said, give me 90 days, my first 100 days or whatever, and you'll be able to take off your mask. Take off your 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I don't know what number we're on, mask. They didn't want to say it when Trump was president because they didn't want to give him a victory. But we all knew all along that wearing a mask was just a bunch of hogwash, especially wearing a mask outside. Now, if you're in a closed-in area, that's a different story. But outside, are you serious? The transmission rate of this thing? But again, they just, hey, no, Joe, he did this and Joe got the vaccine. No, Joe didn't get the vaccine. The vaccine is Trump's vaccine with Operation Warp Speed. Because if I recall, many on the left said that, including Dr. Fauci, that it would be 2 years before we had a vaccine. But we got the vaccine because of Operation Warp Speed. Now, I know that there are those that are out there that are questioning the vaccine. They're afraid because they said, oh, it was too quick. It was too fast. But what you have to remember, folks, is that they did cut through a lot of the red tape, a lot of the bureaucracy that usually goes into putting a vaccine or any type of medicine that the FDA or CDC has to approve, goes through a lot of red tape. So Trump slashed that, as he did with a lot of other regulations, which got us great job growth and whatnot. So my take on his 100 days is completely different than everyone else's. But again, we have Michael Johns, who's on tonight, who's going to talk about it.
Yeah, and without further ado, let's welcome in our guest, co-founder of the Tea Party, the man who I like to say is an encyclopedia of knowledge, Michael Johns. Michael, how are you doing tonight?
Good to speak with you guys. How you been?
Doing great. Well, Michael, we are just a little over 100 days into Joe Biden's administration, and there's a lot to cover here, from the canceling of the Keystone Pipeline, the border crisis, the Paris Climate Accord that he's re-entered into, and the surge in violence all across America. I don't know where do you start, but what have you thought of the first 100 days so far of Joe Biden?
I think you have to kind of put it in that category of a universal disaster, a universal failure. Tough to sort of identify something, you know, even if you were to suspend any degree of preconceived vision of this presidency, where he is succeeding. So, you know, to go through the logical things, you mentioned the border, and you have to kind of almost start with that, because this was a situation that was a mess under Obama and Biden. It was unmanaged. They had no real demonstrable commitment or seemingly any interest in securing it. And we had, you know, illegals and fentanyl, and highlights of illegal alien violent crime in the country, all of the burden on public resources. In comes President Trump, in part winning, you know, on a few different issues, but this clearly was a big one. The American people didn't like the way it was being managed, and he patched together a series of policies that were not a permanent solution, but they essentially put the crisis, you know, to rest. And of course, Biden's arrival, just, you know, repealing all of these orders and putting in place a policy that is just seemingly designed to create the very chaos that it actually is creating. So that's number one. And, you know, we're talking about a very organized, structured for-profit business of transporting individuals, including unaccompanied minors, into this country for profit. Once they arrive here, they're, you know, often still owing those who had, you know, paid for this back in their home country, or those who provided the actual you know, individuals who accompanied them all the way up here. And that creates a whole demand for illegal employment and low wage, difficult labor conditions, and most concerning gang and crime activity and drug and sexual trafficking. So this is just a universal nightmare. There's nothing humanitarian about it. It's inhumane. It's un-American. And it's sadly been distorted by the left in a way as if we're doing favors here to certain people, or that there's something distinct and unique about what's going on in Latin America that hasn't been going on there for 30 years. And they're, you know, these are not asylum candidates. And yet this president has, through his policies and his rhetoric, invited this crisis. And I think we're just in the beginning part of it. Then you move on, you say, yeah, I mean, you know, going back into this Paris Accord, completely flawed. Flawed in the way that it's part of this global reset, the managed decline philosophy of the United States of America, under which we're going to consciously reallocate and redistribute vast sums of money to various countries for very speculative and unclear purposes, and also inhibit our own energy development while the world's largest polluter far and away, China's Communist Party, has no restrictions for decades on what it's allowed to do. So this is, you know, really like one of those policies, one of many, frankly, that, you know, looks like it's straight out of Beijing, because they're going to be the big winners in it. We're going to be the big losers. We're going to pay more for energy. We're going to lose energy jobs while their economy continues to accelerate as part of their design of global economic leadership here in the next few years, certainly in our lifetime, as part of this CCP goal.
Michael.
And I guess just a quick final point is that, you know, he comes in basically with this inaugural speech, which to me was a real strategic decision, like as far as what themes do you focus on? And he had no shortage of opportunities with obviously the pandemic and you know, broad range of economic challenges, but he focused on the issue instead of healing what he depicted as some sort of divide in the country politically. And it's true that there were and are passionate views on both sides, particularly as it relates on a personal level to Trump, not even as much to his policies, but toward Trump. Lots of very strong support, lots of strong opposition. And you have to look at it and say, this guy in 100 days has not lifted one finger for the purposes of bipartisan collaboration. He has failed to work with any Republicans in Congress, and even Democrats in Congress have felt, you know, really they haven't been sufficiently consulted. So it's been a government basically of West Wing ideological leadership at the expense of any healing. And I think he's proving a divisive, not a uniting force in American politics.
So that being said, why is it that, and I know the answer, so it's kind of a rhetorical question, that the media, they're not calling him out on this? He has not been a uniter. He hasn't worked with Republicans. And even Republicans had said, well, we should be able to work with him. But he hasn't even, so it seems, spoken to them. Maybe he's spoken to Mitch McConnell. I don't know. But we haven't seen him with any of them, the customary picture with them talking together and showing the country that, you know, we're divided, but we're going to work together. It's almost as if though they're saying, we don't care who you are or what you say. We have the power and we're going to do what we want to do.
Yeah. So it serves that this extreme ideological vision that those around him carry with them into the Biden White House. But it's bad public policy, which means it's bad for America and Americans. And I think it's bad politics, meaning one of the great opportunities that you're sort of afforded in these first 100 days is the fresh start, a honeymoon period. I mean, he could come in and define himself however he really wanted. I mean, you've got this extraordinary flexibility, because even in this case where the guy's got a 47-year track record of service in the swamp, you're sort of hitting the restart button. And if he had brought in, you know, Republicans and particularly on this infrastructure initiative, there's so much bipartisan support for an infrastructure bill. I think he would have gotten a lot of cooperation and support. There's, you know, he could have taken on this immigration issue and tried to, you know, heal the divide over that as it relates both the border security and this perception that we ought to be doing something with those who've been here illegally for a period of time or for a considerable part of their lives, and particularly these so-called dreamers. I'm not a fan of that, but that deal has been sitting out there sort of waiting to be had. And even Trump flirted with it for a period of time. He had no interest in doing that. The goal was just to bring in more illegals, create more chaos, you know, killing off the energy industry, no cooperation on those vital issues. You know, we're essentially now going to, you know, allow our foreign adversaries, once again, adversaries and countries that, as we say, don't like us too much. I mean, they're not all adversaries, but, you know, we're looking at losing the leadership that Trump was able to establish in being a self-sustaining provider of our own energy and actually a net exporter for the first time in a long time. No cooperation, no real consideration of the impact on the jobs, no communication with the senators or members of Congress who represented these districts where jobs are going to be lost. And even on this immigration issue, they're flying these illegals all over the country. Some of them don't even have court appearance papers. They're being dropped into districts with no advance notice. They're going to be put into public schools. They're going to serve as extraordinary diversions and disruptions. You know, you're arriving not really speaking the English language, and some of them, you know, into the high school years where, you almost have to dedicate full-time personnel just to the language issue, with very limited expectations elsewhere. And then these schools not being open is another issue that just is, I think, baffling and irritating to the American people. Clearly, you know, we're being lectured to in a condescending way about listening to the science, and there's almost no issue on which the science regarding this particular virus that we hadn't seen before, we had no experience with it. So it's not like there's decades of track record on the science. But one thing that is clear on the science is that it's safe for these schools to reopen, that these kids are at very limited exposure. The very minimal protection efforts would leave them completely safe, and that we are depriving them and doing vastly more harm to them from the standpoint of their educational development in not allowing them back into schools. And we're now talking about like a year and a half of, you know, these kids missing out on key parts of their education and their preparation for adulthood. It's tough not to look at that and say that we're going to have, like, you know, a generation there, a fraction of a generation of individuals who literally lost out on part of this education, and not really getting any clear-cut explanation as to why either, which is the other frustrating aspect of this, is that he went, you know, considerable part of this first 100 days without any press conference at all. The one he had wasn't really faced with any of the most pressing questions that I think deserve to be asked. I don't want to seem like, because we talked kind of leading into this administration and during the transition and during the campaign, as I recall, and I've not had much optimism about what I thought we were going to face. So it'd be disingenuous to say I'm shocked with what we're confronting. I'm not shocked. I think we're getting what I expected, but I think what those of us close to it expected is one thing. I think the American people expected a lot more than what they're actually getting.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, a lot of us are getting what we expected. You were just talking about the effect that the schools being shut down has had on the kids. But this past couple of months under the Joe Biden administration, we've seen a big uptick in mass shootings happening around the country. Do you think that's also a direct result of these lockdowns and people being stuck inside their homes for a year and a half?
Yeah, I think the singular greatest issue, just take gun violence as a whole. I mean, we don't talk enough about the statistics, but I noticed we got another case now going to the Supreme Court, and it's just refreshing itself on some of these statistics. I mean, we have somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million violent crimes a year that are prevented because of our Second Amendment and the right to legal gun ownership. So it seems like every time the topic of guns comes up, we talk about gun violence, and that's obviously a hugely important topic, but it's not the only topic. I mean, we have lives, extraordinary numbers of lives every year saved only because we have this Second Amendment. But then you get into gun violence and you say, what are the real problems with gun violence? Well, number one is suicides. That's 2/3 of shooting deaths with guns. That is essentially a mental health problem, crisis, really, that we confront as a country. I think we still have insufficient resources available, and that includes to younger people. There's still stigma in certain areas of the country about pursuing mental health treatment, and that's associated in a lot of ways with these mass shootings. It's important to point out these mass shootings are major news developments, and they're tragic, deplorable, reprehensible, maybe preventable, hopefully preventable, but they still comprise a very, very small percentage of total gun deaths in the country, nor are they becoming more prominent. I think they're becoming more prominent in the coverage and in the politicization of them to tie them into gun legislation. But to answer your question, absolutely. It seems to me that the correlation between mental health, depression, anxiety, the associated psychological impact of isolation can only have a detrimental effect for people that, especially for those who might have predisposition to these issues. And I said the same thing about the BLM violent riots in the streets. I mean, you know, it's just tough to imagine that the singular motivating factor in cities, you know, far removed from Minneapolis was this incident. It was, you know, I think in part, you know, the isolation of those of individuals for a long period of time, you know, created and poured some gasoline on that fire that already would have existed, and it would have existed, and you know, that would have happened regardless of it. So I'm not saying it's a sole factor or even a major contributing factor, but it is a factor. And you know, these decisions, policy decisions, are always, they're like ledgers. You know, it's like on one hand, here are the benefits of policy A, here are the benefits of policy B. And we continue to be in a political culture where, you know, the arguments of the left are prominently and persuasively often presented. And our side is always playing catch up, always on defense, very rarely on offense. And that seems to be the case on just about every issue we're confronting right now in the country. I mean, I don't see any offensive policy strategy coming out of the House or Senate Republican leadership. It's all defense, how to minimize the damage, how to contain Biden's aggressiveness. And this is a problem that's been going on for a decade at least.
Why do you think that we're always on the offense? I've said before on the show that I think that Republicans, conservatives have lost the war as far as a culture war to the Democrats. We've conceded too much ground. We're afraid to talk about social issues. And I don't understand why. I don't know if it's because the party has gotten old. We have more older people that are there and they're not in tune to the social issues. We just decided to just let it go. But it's so important because the young people are the future voters. The party won't always be defined by old men. And as the left like to say, old white men. There's so much diversity that's out there, but we're afraid, it seems, to go out there and reach out to the different groups. Now, I will say that I can see where it might be jarring, it might be uncomfortable, but we've got to have those uncomfortable moments in order to bring people in, people that are there on the sidelines, that want something different, that think the way we think or have the same ideas, that basic conservative principle, but we are yet to walk out there. And Andrew, we've spoken about this before, you know, we won't walk out there and bring them into the party and have that conversation.
Well, also, I think, Rob, you got to realize that, as I know you do, that there are some things that government can do on a federal and state level, but there's only so many things, you know, and so you're really dealing in a lot of ways with parental development, communities, and, you know, where does one's character ultimately get shaped? You know, I would say, be curious how you guys would answer that question, but I would say growing up, the role of government in my life before the age of 18 was not something I gave a whole lot of thought to. I'm influenced by my parents, influenced by my friends, influenced by my school, influenced by my teachers, influenced by, you know, positive and negative forces, you know, both sides of the magnet, like I think most kids are growing up. but it's really a number of institutions. Schools really matter a lot, and then the home environment really matters a lot. And then you got to add on top of that that it's difficult to tell young people what to do. You can overdo it. And there's cases where you see them move in the opposite direction. It's a, you know, as a parent myself, it's I always viewed it as a persuasive effort, you know what I mean? To sort of point to the positive outcomes with positive behavior and positive initiatives, and the opposite also being true. And then every kid's different, you know, I mean, so that like approach worked in my case, and it may not work in other cases. And nobody really gives you a handbook on how to be a great parent, but it starts with being present, and it starts with being involved and tuned in to what's going on with kids. And I think we've, with rising divorce cases and with lack of presence of sometimes one parent not present at all, the impact of that is monumental, because even if the other parent has the best of intentions, it's they're bringing half the effort. And then you look at the school structure, and yeah, I think you have to say there's an element of government influence there clearly with, you know, public policy and the issues that we've focused on and haven't focused on over the last, you know, sort of 10 years or so. I mean, just a heavy degree of focus on these sort of, you know, extreme radical positions of consideration for, you know, transsexual rights and the perceived inclusion of everyone. And those are legitimate discussions, legitimate issues, I suppose. And then you need answers to them one way or the other. But, you know, the fundamental issues of like, how do we improve and our students so that they're graduating in a position to compete with students graduating, you know, in Germany and Japan and in China, in South Korea, in other major economies that where they're going to have to compete is we're falling behind. And a lot of it is a cultural phenomenon. You know, it's the magnitude of academic discipline isn't there, and it's a complicated question. I don't think it's a simple, doesn't even all fall on kids. I mean, you know, these teachers need to make education interesting and appealing. We probably could do more to attract better teachers, more successful teachers. I don't think we do enough to measure this. You know, in business, you always say, you know, anything that's important is worth measuring. That's kind of a phrase. And if you're not measuring it, it's not important. Well, we don't really measure, you know, a lot of things in education. I think we get like basically these SAT scores, graduation rates, maybe college admissions. Those are interesting, but, you know, what about these kids that fall, you know, by the wayside, who underperform, who drop out even in extreme cases? I mean, what are the factors and forces that are driving those things? And what are the policy solutions there? And there's just a lot of people, I think, who get through the primary school and they don't feel that they've gotten the personalized attention or the developmental guidance that, you know, that they could have or should have. And then when you're not getting that, your attitude can turn negative pretty quickly. You know, I look at the contrast even in my own. I look at my collegiate level, I thought was pretty attentive. You know, the professors are very involved. And if I go back and look at growing up in high school in Eastern Pennsylvania, it was more of a mixed bag. You know, there was some positive influences and some, it just seemed like they were logging time. Now, why is that? Why, you know, most jobs, you know, that's not the way you kind of perform. And I think a lot of it is that we're not really, we have no merit pay still, right? I think that started being, we started talking about that in like the 1980s about merit pay. Still doesn't exist. Basically, it's all union negotiated pay. Everybody gets paid the same. So everybody, you know, you kind of create a culture where you're incentivized to do the bare minimum. And some of these teachers really outperform, but that's the rare exception. And then, you know, the structure of our education system, I think, just needs to be evaluated because it's being pulled in some negative directions. And the positive things we could be doing, like school choice, so crucially important. You know, no parent should have to send their kid to a bad performing school, is, you know, still not a reality in this country for most. And, you know, and the personalization of education, you know, the idea that no child really learns the same way as the child next to them. Everyone learns differently. And tailoring education in that kind of personal way is important, and we don't do much of that either. Absolutely. It doesn't, now all of this is probably costly, and I will say there is, contrary to what the left says, you know, they just put all of this money into education and they don't even know where they're going to spend it. I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars for services were actually less than what they promised to have provided prior to this pandemic. It doesn't necessarily always mean a whole lot more money. It requires more attentive management, more metrics, more understanding, I think, of student experiences.
Absolutely. And I think everyone agrees that we need to fix our school system. You guys are tuned in to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on the iHeartRadio Network, Spotify, Stitcher, or just about any other audio app. Check out the website, AmericaOutLoud.com, which has recently just celebrated its fifth anniversary. With more on Joe Biden's first 100 days, the war in Iraq ending, and more with guest Michael Johns.
AmericaOutLoud.com. Simply put, we're patriots who believe in Ronald Reagan's vision of a shining city on a hill. From sea to shining sea, you can listen in on iHeartRadio. Our free apps are on Apple, Android, or Alexa, or our world-class media player. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Now, never before in our history have we witnessed the level of hatred that is now being waged against our law enforcement. While anarchist groups create havoc and overwhelm our first responders, these same groups and their corporate supporters are calling for the police forces to be shrunk and defunded. What can you and I do to make a difference? How can we stand up for what is right and to show our support? That's what I'm going to tell you about this incredible new platform. It's called ShopToTheRight.com. And it's a new shopping platform that will help you find businesses that align with your values. They feature products made in America. They support veteran-owned businesses as well as our law enforcement community. This is a time when we need to stick together. We need to shop together, and we need to support each other. It's time for you and I to make some noise and stand up to protect our country. And one easy way to do that is to shop and give our money to companies that don't seek to destroy our way of life. So join the fight for liberty. ShopToTheRight.com. Support those American businesses that support law enforcement and veterans.
And we're back with our guest, Michael Johns. And before we went to break, Michael, you were talking about the education and how, you know, the education here in America is just not what it should be. And I know that the left, they are really against charter schools. They're pushing public schools. But when we look at what happened during the pandemic and a lot of the schools were closed And then trying to get those schools open and getting the kids back inside the classroom has been rather a challenge. But you look at the kids that are coming across from the border, and we're providing them, so it seems, with great education. Like you said, they're sending them all across the nation in airplanes and busing them into our schools, which will definitely be disruptive because of the language barrier. And not only that, there's also, I think in West Virginia, they're looking at dumbing down, so to speak, math, taking math out of the curriculum. And just, I don't get it. What are they thinking, or why aren't thinking? How can we compete?
Well, I mean, the big picture problem challenge that we're up against is an extraordinary one, and that is this mass movement toward a managed decline. I mean, this is kind of the Davos crowd of global elites who have planned the way they want to see the world play out. And it shouldn't surprise us that the world's wealthiest and most powerful would get together and come together with a plan. And part of that plan is to kind of designate, you know, what each individual country's kind of respective role is. And this is something that I think the American people need to wake up to. I think they are to some extent waking up to, but, you know, this plan in essence puts China at the center of everything and relegates America to a decidedly lower tier of global prominence and leadership. So you look at this border crisis and you say, yeah, exactly. What are they thinking? Well, part of this functional role of this plan is for the United States to serve as the dumping ground for refugees that are going to be fleeing poverty and other extreme conditions as a result of all of this, because it's a transitional period. This whole thing has to be rejected. I mean, the more you reflect on the 2016 agenda of former President Trump, the more you have to say, you know, he nailed it head on, is that this wasn't just an issue of making America great again, but that we had no alternative not to do that because we're facing, you know, forces globally, including sadly in our own country, who have bought into this agenda and who do not want the best for the United States of America. In fact, they're executing on a plan that is, you know, really consciously designed to diminish our global competitiveness, our economic strength, our sovereignty and independence, all of these things under attack as part of a correlated effort that they've embraced. So you have to first understand it, and then we have to put together our plan to fight back against it. And you've heard my perception on our movement right now is I don't think we are bringing the magnitude of seriousness or the magnitude of collective strength that's necessary for us to prevail. That's why we've been losing to date. That doesn't mean we need to continue losing. But if we don't change our ways, there's no reason to believe that this is going to just automatically reverse. And I would say, you know, even if we're winning the battle of public opinion, it's not enough. I mean, we're losing whole institutions in this country that have just been swept up. There's been no accountability whatsoever for anyone in maintaining, you know, the excellence and neutrality of these institutions. And, you know, we've gone through them. It's media, you know, pretty much solidly in the hands of the left, corporate media, at least. You've got academia, just forget it. I mean, you've got like three or four credible institutions like Hillsdale and Liberty University and a few others that, are adhering to some of our conservative and founding principles as part of the core curriculum, but they've been abandoned at just about every other university, public or private, in this country. You send your kids to these places, you can't expect that they're going to get exposure to them. They're if they have exposure to them, they're likely going to be derided and denounced by these professors, most of whom have just this bizarre dislike in a lot of cases for our national sovereignty and our national greatness.
Is it even worth going to those universities, sending your kids to those universities?
Yeah, some say it's not. I think it depends ultimately on, like I said, every kid's different. So, I mean, when I went through college, my views were pretty identical to what they are right now. They haven't shifted too much. I think I know a lot more now than I did, but, they were pretty much the same. And I was subjected to professors that were left of center, and it didn't have any effect on me. In fact, it's the opposite. You kind of had that teenage, kind of instinct to push back on it a little bit. I don't know where that instinct is today. I speak on these campuses and with students, and these are like mini militias almost that exist on these campuses, where they're out to disrupt and destroy and sometimes violently anyone who comes challenging their globalist Marxist agenda. And it's really more of a globalist agenda than it is a Marxist agenda, right? Because I'm not hearing them putting a lot of focus on the nationalization of industries, with the exception of healthcare, which they continue to focus on, right? They're not saying necessarily nationalize these industries. They want to see an economy where industries are aligned with their agenda. And they've made great headway there too. I mean, I open up business media and whatnot. It's incredible the amount of left of center bias and social engineering that's kind of become at the centerpiece of business journalism in this country.
Well, I think the word that you use, mini militias, is that says it all, because that's what you're walking into when you go to these college campuses. And we've heard it from different conservative speakers that once they step on campus, they're attacked, because these kids think that you're attacking them personally. And we had another guest who even said it's like their religion. People hold their religion so sacred and dear. Right. And if you say anything to the contrary, that's it. They are full blown attack mode to take you down.
Well, I think I agree with that completely. And I also would say that, the other component of it is, in my own experience, they throw these huge security fees on conservatives. Like when I go to speak, it's like 10 grand they'll put on an organization to provide security, which is totally unnecessary. It's only necessary because they refuse to enforce their code of conduct. So the way I worded it is, if you went and did to any other event on a campus what the left does to conservative speakers, if you tried to disrupt a class, or if you tried to disrupt an administrative building or a sporting event or a cultural event in the way that they've done with conservative speakers, there would be ramifications. There are no ramifications. It's somehow they implicitly are permissive of this behavior, even though it does violate the letter of the code of conduct. And what message gets sent by that? The message sent is keep it up, keep up the good work, keep disrupting these guys and creating scenes of chaos. Very rarely, almost never, do you see examples where these individuals pay any price, no suspensions, not even serious warnings. I've spoken on campuses where these individuals who were involved in physical disruption actually are identified by name, and in media coverage and whatnot. The administration doesn't follow up. They have no interest whatsoever in pursuing it. At that point, it's really a campus regulation in name only. It doesn't exist in practice. Everyone knows that. And once the word is out that you can pull off this sort of behavior with no ramifications whatsoever, I mean, it's obviously an incentive for them to only escalate what they're doing.
Well, you look at what happened the spring and summer of 2020 with the protests turned riots, and the way they categorize them being the folks on the left, is saying that they were peaceful rallies. And even there was one CNN commentator who said that, show me where protests have to be peaceful. Yeah. And there was no ramifications for what they did, burn down towns, state, federal buildings. Police officers were injured. Two police officers were killed. And nothing.
19
they arrested them.
Last I checked, 19 total deaths.
So 19. They arrested them and then they let them out. Whereas you look at January 6th, at the individuals that they say the insurrection, in parentheses, the White House, some of them are still in jail. Now, granted, they shouldn't have been there and there's a cost to pay, but why are they still sitting in jail? And the hundreds of individuals that ransacked different cities and towns during the spring and summer of 2020, and just recently, this year, this month, nothing. The FBI is not actively going out to find them. They're not looking at video cameras or asking people. It's almost as if though this behavior is being rewarded. And I always say, this is 2021. What has changed? What in our value system has gotten so low?
If you break that down, it's a good question. Number one is the big money has gone into getting these DAs, these prosecutors put into position who refuse to enforce the rule of law, right? So part of the—
Which is really sad.
Yeah, so we've had this politicization of American justice, not just on the local and state level, but you've seen it, even in the Department of Justice. I mean, how's the DOJ investigation going into the Navarro report? Where's the Obamagate ramifications? We were victimized with the IRS targeting an entire movement. No one paid any, there were no criminal ramifications whatsoever. And yet, on the other side, I mean, you saw a whole broad range of individuals prosecuted in sweeping investigations where, their underlying offenses weren't even related to the investigation, harshly treated, put through great legal expense, treated horribly. We're confronting a breakdown of the country that is not even conceptual as we've historically described it. I mean, so many times we'd say, if we don't, sort of get our act together, A, B, and C are going to happen. We're into A, B, and C now happening. And I think logic, a kind of managerial logic, starts with saying, who's accountable, right? So the individuals who were charged, whether they're public officials or whether they're individuals who were leadership positions in our movement, that were responsible in theory to making sure these things didn't happen, completely failed us. And we should stop talking around that. I mean, they might be very decent people. They might be great roles for them to play in other components, but their leadership in the functions that we charged them with was completely unacceptable. And to have this level of corruption and double standard applied, literally at the highest levels of American justice, in the American intel agencies, now increasingly in our own Pentagon and our defense forces, it's reflective of not us fighting and losing, but us never even putting up the fight. And we have some real issues as it relates to just personnel. And I hope that if we've learned any lesson in the last 4 years, it's we can have the greatest ideas. We can even pack arenas full of people who agree with our agenda. But if you're going to let the other side control all these institutions, run these key functional areas on which our constitutional republic rests, you're going to lose, and you're going to lose badly. And we're going to just sit around continuing to complain and be outraged. And it's been like, you know, years and years now where we've been expressing outrage. I mean, people have made whole careers out of writing books, doing documentaries, hosting TV shows, where, you know, pretty much exclusively what they do is present the outrage of the day. And the American, you know, and then that draws an audience of people that go, yeah, that is outrageous. That's ridiculous. Surely somebody's going to do something about it. But the somebody is not really there to do anything about it. That's a thing we've learned. And it certainly became crystal clear to me on November 3. I would never have imagined that we would be sitting here with the, you know, to revisit. And by the way, we can't move on until these issues are resolved. Two issues need to be resolved. The Wuhan viral, the origin of the virus, which almost certainly came from the Wuhan clinic, and Fauci's own role in funding that, where he has not even, how many interviews has this guy done since this pandemic? I don't believe he's been asked once about what sort of thinking went into funding that.
Not one at all.
And I believe that we are back to again funding it now under Biden.
Yeah, it would be nice if the media would start asking Dr. Fauci real questions so we could get this pandemic under control.
Well, this, you know, I know it's been said before, but I went through literally every major decision that's been made on this pandemic, he was on the wrong side of. He was on the wrong side, firstly, and I could, you know, and all this is documentable too, by the way. This isn't speculation. You know, these are all like video interviews he's done, and they're all out there for anybody who cares to look. You know, he was the one in January of 2020 who was telling us there was absolutely nothing to worry about when Navarro and others were saying, oh no, this has got like the potential to be a seven-figure pandemic. He was the one who opposed the travel ban that President Trump correctly put in place the end of January. He was wrong on the therapeutics, famously. He was, you know, wrong in his projection of how long the vaccine would take to develop when he said no way it could be done in a year. He's clearly wrong on the core origin of this gain-of-function research. Dangerous research, hugely dangerous, you know, utilized predominantly for biological warfare, which almost certainly is what was going on in that clinic.
Yeah, Michael, just to put a bow on this conversation on Joe Biden's first 100 days, as you mentioned earlier, the guy has only done one press conference. We barely see much of him, just like during the campaign when he didn't even bother to campaign. He's had the viral video of him falling down the stairs. Do you think that Joe Biden is going to make it to 2024 still as president?
I'd just be guessing because I don't really know, but I feel we're deserving to know what the physical or neurological diagnosis of the man is. I mean, clearly something's wrong. I don't think anyone's disputing that. And I don't know what it is. I followed this guy's career now for decades. It's so obvious that there's this immense deterioration. And I would say, you know, can the administration function with the president sort of, you know, logging a 25-hour work week? I guess it probably could, but that's, you know, the American people ostensibly elected this guy. They didn't elect all these you know, these appointed officials.
Have you ever seen that with all your years in politics, a president of the United States that we see so little of?
No, this is a job where you are in. Now, he's benefited because he's used the pandemic to justify not being as out as necessary. But no, I've never, there's no modern or maybe even any historical precedent.
And the media, they cover for him. They don't call him out. They allow him to hide and to dodge, and they justify it. Every time he makes a mistake, that things that are so clear that it would be an average person would say, what's going on here? But they will cover. He mispronounces a name, they will cover. And they'll come back with the press conference and saying, oh, well, he's the greatest thing, or he did this, he did that. There is an issue here. And if Americans can't see it, I'm sorry, because the other countries
do see it. That's what's good. I'm going to tell you something. Unlike, say, 20 years ago when we had this liberal media bias, it was frustrating because we didn't feel American people were seeing the bias. And in fairness to the American people, it was difficult to see because it was not as blatant, not as obvious, and not as comprehensive. It's now so blatant, so obvious, and so comprehensive that the American people do see right through it.
So why aren't we mad?
That's why media's credibility is lower than just about any other institution in this country.
But so if we see it, and it's embarrassing, why aren't we in the streets? Why aren't we demanding that we know his medical records, what's going on? They demanded it of Trump. Why aren't we just out there? And maybe we are, but the media is downplaying it. They're not allowing those voices. Big tech isn't allowing those voices to be heard. They're squashing it. Because like I said, I mean, it's to the point, you would have to be blind, or maybe we just don't care. We see it and we don't care.
Well, no, I from a leadership standpoint, people go through a psychological process and they need to be reassured and encouraged. They feel helpless. They don't feel empowered. They feel like these are issues that, and in fact, they are issues, and they're beyond their personal ability to control them. And that can lead to a real level of depression and, you know, kind of retreat from the very things that they should be doing. But this is the moment when you do stand up. So encouraging in the UK to see, you know, these huge protests over the last 2 days on their overly excessive lockdown that's been put in place by real far left advisors of Johnson, including a member of the Communist Party over there. And I think, look, the American people are paying attention. It might be with one eye, but they're paying attention. And the rubber's going to hit the road here pretty soon, I think. You know, the schools are going to have to open, or I think you're going to start to see an outpouring of opposition exactly like that. And this border is going to have to be secured or otherwise resolved. You're going to see an outpouring of opposition to that. The other issues are a little more complicated, and we're going to have to articulate them. But I'm telling you, the rage is beginning to build, and the rage is justified.
Yeah, well said. Thank you so much to our guest, Michael Johns, co-founder of the Tea Party and former White House speechwriter. We definitely want to have him back soon so he can give us some thoughts on the end of the war to Iraq. We didn't quite get to that tonight, but we will have Michael back on soon to discuss that. Thank you for joining us tonight on After Dark with Rob and Andrew. Check us out and all the other shows over at AmericaOutloud.com, who just celebrated its 5th anniversary. You can also find America Out Loud on iHeartRadio, Spotify, or Stitcher. We will see you next time, and remember, stand for something or you will fall for nothing.